Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The subject of my address this evening is Germany. And I'm going to call it before and after. I'm not a young man, and I'm not given to making snap decisions of judgment. It takes a lot to impress me. I would like to start by telling you that I joined the army under age in the 20s after the First World War. I never gave my right age, I would like to add. In consequence, I found myself in Germany in the Army of Occupation when I was about 18 years old. And during my sojourn in Germany, I stayed for the most part in the Rhineland area, first in Cologne, and finally in Wiesbaden, where you may or may not know was the final wind-up of the British Army, or what is known as the Watch on the Rhine, after the First World War, in 1929, in the Wilhelmstrasse, which was the centre of the British occupation in Germany. The Union Jack came down for the last time, and after all the ceremonial business associated with it, we left Germany for good and came back to Britain. Now, during the period that I remained in Germany, the impressions and much of the way of life of the German people remained with me and has remained with me all my life. I came to know a few people personally. Some, in fact, it transpired, became lifelong friends. And it is about this and my views on Germany, my impressions, that I would like to speak to you this evening. Well, I left Germany in 1929. Came back to Britain, which was still not in a very good position from an economic point of view. I didn't know. I'd heard whisperings about a man named Hitler, but like most people at that particular time, knew very little about him or his party. In fact, I knew very little of politics in general. In fact, the whole of my particular discussion this evening will not be centered around politics as such, but purely to my impressions, my feelings, my observations associated with what I saw, and mainly with what I felt. As you know, 4 years after the British Army left Germany in 1933, we saw the inauguration of Adolf Hitler as the Reich Chancellor, which existed for a few months, after which he was proclaimed Führer. Now, we have heard, and we've read, we've heard eminent people, these people who are credited with being eminent people, discuss Germany. They've called Hitler and the Third Reich, and the Nazi Party, all the names imaginable. But believe me, they have no idea, if they speak the truth, of what they would speak, what they were talking about. Now, during the period of my occupation in Germany, it must be remembered that the unemployment figure of Germany, as she was then, she was not the greater Germany of the Third Reich, she was an ordinary Germany, not a wonderful lot bigger than the existing Germany as she is today, Western Germany, perhaps with the addition of the Russian-occupied territory, Berlin, Prussia, Silesia, East Prussia, that made up the Germany. And yet, at one period, there were 14 million unemployed. Now, people, I would say, do not realize the magnitude of this number of people being unemployed. There was no such thing in those days of unemployment relief. There was simply nothing for these people. They lived the best way they could, which was, on my own experience, my own knowledge, was pretty awful. They used to get little handouts from church and a few other local bodies. They would come to the barracks where all the British soldiers were. They had bought for a few pfennigs the scraps off the tables and from the kitchens. I've seen some sights there which when one sees, for instance, the pictures they show us today of places like Bangladesh and India and all the rest of it, they surpass even that. These lovely little children, white children, blonde-haired children, literally starving, in the depth of winter with no boots or shoes, because there were none to buy, there were none to be had. The shops were empty. The reason I make these points today is not to give you a political argument, but to give you a true picture of things, how they really existed in those days, in the late 20s, or between the wars, we'll say, the early part of between the wars. This wonderful help thy neighbour, this democracy, was something which just did not exist. There was no big handout from America. America hadn't reached the stage where they were giving shiploads of wheat and all kinds of assistance and help to Germany or anywhere else like that. So it is, all I will say about the thing is, it is hardly to be wondered at that someone came along. The fact that his name was Adolf Hitler and wasn't John Smith or Joe Doe or somebody else is entirely beside the point. But someone had to come along. The man happened to be Adolf Hitler. Well, now, in 1935, I decided that I would like to go back to Cologne. I'd been in touch by letter with some friends who lived there, and I'd understood that they'd been having rather a rough time, but they'd remarked on how things were improving under the Nazi system of government. So I decided that I, with my wife, we would go back for a short holiday. So come August, I think it was August, it could have been July, however it isn't important. I bought the tickets and we took the train from Dover, from Victoria rather, to Dover, from Dover over to Ostend. From Ostend, we took a train through Belgium to the frontier, to Aix-la-Chapelle, and through a little bit of no man's land until we arrived at the first major station in Germany in that area, Aachen, which of course has since been very much in the news. Well now, after leaving Germany with all those unemployed and the apparent seamingness no hope and no future for these people. It was as if the train in which I was sitting had suddenly driven through an invisible curtain and we'd entered a different land altogether. The sight which met my eyes was something even I would find it most difficult to describe. Everything seemed to have taken on a clean, new, glossy appearance. Mark you, the German people, even in their poverty and misery, were always tidy, thorough, and a clean living people. But the sight that met my eyes surpassed almost anything I'd ever seen before. When the train came to stop, so many things seemed to happen all at once. The first thing was, of course, my visual aspect of the various groups of people who were intentionally there to meet the train. There were a contingent of the SS, that was the German, in those days I believe they were the German military police, which would be found usually at the frontier control post, all in their smart dark blue uniforms, with insignia and one thing or another. There was a small contingent of the Nazis themselves in the brown uniforms. I forget the specific name that they gave to them now. It was some years ago. They had all the breastplates and medals and one thing or another on them. There were the railway officials in bright bottle green uniforms. And also a large number of stewards and stewardesses in white coats. Now, while my visual aspect was trying to absorb all these wonderful things, the loudspeaker on the station came into action, and a voice, a male voice in excellent English, said these very words. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Germany. Will you kindly remain seated in your seat while the controller, the customs and excise and the passport examiner will come through the train and see if you have anything to declare and check your tickets and so on and so forth. We sincerely hope you enjoy your stay in Germany. That was all he said. This was said in three or four languages. And through a couple of young fellows came round and through the compartments of the train. Looked at our passports, spoke to them, could speak perfect English, every one of them. The only thing they asked was at the time, had we any coffee? Because apparently coffee at that particular time was at a premium in Germany. Very expensive. We said no, we hadn't coffee, but we had some tea, which we'd bought with us for our own consumption. But anyway, they smiled, this was permissible, and everything was okay as far as I was concerned. Our passport was duly stamped. They again wished us a happy stay whilst in Germany, the way they went. But many of the things which transpired at the same time, this never all took place all at once. I think the train was some 20 minutes in the station at Aachen. But several things became very clear to me, that there seemed to be an atmosphere prevailing as if the people had been given a new lease of life. At last, suddenly, there was something to live for. There was a real joy in their faces. There was no slouching around as if one'd done what they had to do with bad grace. It seemed that everyone was pleased to be doing what exactly and whatever they were doing. Even the stewards, for instance, I noticed, walked up to the brass handles of the railway carriages and gave them a good rub and a polish up before ever any of the officials went onto the train. It must be remembered the Germans have a very high regard for hygiene and things of this description. And immediately while the customs and other officials were going through the train, the stewards were going through the train and changing all the napery and towels and I believe they call them hands and the castors on the back of the upholstery on the train seat. They were all changed. Everything was toughed out. What was likely to be dirty or was soiled in any way, shape or form, and the whole lot changed. So therefore my impression started right bang from that very moment. It was just as though I'd walked into a fairyland. Now, a few things struck me as being strange. I noticed that people were saluting each other in the street. They were saying Heil Hitler to each other. I found myself constantly looking around to see if what prompted them to do it, to see if there was anyone looking, watching them, any, if there was any, of course you can imagine, after all, at this particular time, and of course the year or two preceding it, we'd heard all kinds of stories, you know, in Britain, about how the Germans had been forced to do this and forced to do the other, how they couldn't get this and they couldn't get the other, that things were in a very, very bad shape. We've seen all kinds of pictures purporting to testify to the truth of some of the assertions made by reporters and other people who I've since learned were left-wing individuals whose one aim was to try to cause trouble. Unfortunately, they succeeded in the long term. However, I didn't know much about this sort of thing at the time. And I'm merely stating now my impressions. I found there was no one prompting them to do anything. They would do whatever they were doing of their own free will. It seemed as if in such a short time it was impossible that things could have changed for the better to such a degree. The thin wine look on the faces of the individuals had suddenly changed. They were becoming robust, not fat and portly as they did become in the latter years preceding the war, but sinewy and healthy looking. This was when, I believe, the worker battalions had been formed and the Third Reich had just started to flex its muscles, as I would say. They had started then to build the roads throughout the whole of Germany, which were known as the Autobahn. Their policy of back to the land provided the Germans with a stable diet. If not the fat of the land, at least they were not starving, not by any means. In fact, the place was a hive of industry in one way or another. And also, the Germans' policy was, if you work hard, you're entitled to play hard. And they did. When they'd finished work in the evening, they would be out having their beer and their food and their good time and their sing-song, one thing and another. There were no stupid laws prevailing. For instance, I it was frowned upon by people themselves. This is by... If you never saw a person there with long hair, it was simply out of the question that someone would go along, a man, that should walk around as if he needed a haircut. I spent all my time during that 2 weeks that I had in Germany, all around about Cologne and the Rhine area, up and down the Rhine on the steamers. And I never ceased to wonder how in such a short time things could change for the better, our people could be instilled with a kind of a new lease of life. Now, they weren't all forced. I mean, one gives the impression, one was given the impression in Britain at that time that one would find the secret police and one thing or another around every street corner and people forced to do all kinds of things. But this was not the case at all. People seemed to do whatever they were doing voluntarily. Now, whilst I wouldn't say that I was a first-class linguist, I can speak German rather fluently. I can write a reasonably good letter. So I would say it was rather difficult to fob me off with any false impressions or things of this description. So all in all, I arrived at the conclusion that what was going on in Germany at that particular time in 1935 was done voluntarily with the best will of the majority of people who lived in Germany. Now, of course, I went back to Germany on several occasions between that period, between 1935. The following year, I believe, I went to Nuremberg, went to the rally in Nuremberg. Now, only a person that has actually attended a Nuremberg rally can really understand the feeling, which further emphasizes my earlier views and impressions that everything was done there was done voluntarily. It was the simple answer to it was really one word: patriotism. They were Germans first before they were anything else. They were Germans before they were trade unionists. They were Germans before they were of any specific political party. I had flocked and supported the only man who loved Germany and the German nation. And in and through this love, their strength abounded, and one would have had to have been blind not to see this. My first impression of Nuremberg and the rally, which I attended in 1936, it's something which is very, very difficult to describe. I think most people have had access to pictures which were taken during this period of the hundreds of thousands of troops and party members and supporters who attended this Nuremberg rally. This is something that meant something to these people when they'd play their patriotic tunes, songs, marches. They were all things that meant something and meant a lot to the German people. I forever will wonder and think to myself, why is it not possible that this cannot be instilled into people today throughout the English-speaking world, not only Britain, but Canada, Australia, New Zealand, America. In 1939, I was back again in Germany. I think it was, I was there for the last week. I believe it was the last week in July and the first and part of the second week in August. It was during the talk, of course, that period, there was the talk of possibility of war. It was at the time when Chamberlain had been to see Adolf Hitler at the hotel on the Rhine, Königsberg. It was at the time when all kinds of propaganda was being put over by, particularly by the people who were seeking any means, any straw that they could clutch to engage Germany in a war. They thought that if they could once get Germany into a war, they could stop the growth of nationalism in Europe, or in the world for that matter. White man's nationalism. And unfortunately, they succeeded. A few things stand out very clearly in my mind of 1939. While all this political hocus pocus was going on in Britain, the enactment was only too obvious what was taking place in Germany. Hitler, believe it or not, was forced into that war, not so much by Britain or outside forces, but by his own people. His own people who had been forced to live in the Polish corridor, land which was previously German, which was full of German people, who had since been forced to more or less give up their German nationality and their German way of life. They had been forced to live under a Polish regime, a Polish system, which catered mainly for Polish people. Many of them had been dispossessed from their lands. Their children had to learn Polish at school. The people who lived in East Prussia were pressing all the time that Hitler should do something about it. Now the villainous aspect of the pressure groups in Britain and in other parts of the world had forced Britain into a position where they were prepared more or less to do anything to bring about a war with Germany. Now this went back as far as 1938, if I recall right. In 1938, a plenipotentiary was sent from Britain to Poland and were given, unasked for, guarantees that should she be attacked by Germany, that Britain would go to her assistance. Now, any scholar or reader of history only need to look at the position and relationship between Britain and Poland, which existed for numerous years preceding the Second World War, would know right away that there was no particular love lost. While we were friendly, reasonably friendly, there was no particular love lost between Britain and Poland. So somehow one may ask, why was Britain so suddenly conscious of a predicament that could be brought about by Germany wanting to have a right of way through the corridor? It must be recalled that Germany did not demand the corridor be given back to Germany. Germany merely asked for a right of way through the corridor to connect Germany proper with East Prussia. And this they were denied by the Poles, who thumbed their nose at Germany after having been given guarantees by Britain and France and various other people who were engaged in skullduggery at that particular time. And of course it transpired that when Hitler himself and the German High Command could simply tolerate the situation no longer. They decided to act, and of course they did act, and very quickly, 21 days, the war with Poland was over. And the Germans met the Russians approximately in the center of Poland, because when Germany moved in from their side, the Russians moved into Poland from their side. Most of what I'm saying now is subsequent to what I said originally, and I've learned much about it since, which I didn't know at the time, although I was there in the middle of it. What I would like to mention, of course, was on the brighter side, in 1939, just more or less a few weeks before the war actually started, I found myself with some friends in the nearby city of Düsseldorf. Now, Düsseldorf is a close neighbor of Cologne. It's only a few miles, 5-6 miles away, downriver. At that time of day, it was noted for two things: steel and mustard. The reason we went to Düsseldorf was because it was, I believe, a bicentennial celebration. These particular celebrations were to do with the founding, original founding of the city of Düsseldorf. And I can see the site now before me as it were yesterday. The whole town, in particular the center of Düsseldorf, which is with the canal, the artificial canal running through the center, which is known as the Königs Allee, was absolutely overall bedecked in bunting and German flags and banners and swastika flags and one thing and another. It was simply, the pageantry was beyond belief, really. The enthusiasm of the people that had gone to such great pains to deck the place out like this. No force could have done this by coercion or anything like that. It cannot be compared with some of the austere and cheap decorations which one has seen on pictures emanating from the Red Square Moscow or the similar things which have come from the People's Republic of China. I look back on it now and I think to myself, what a difference in a spontaneous outburst of joy from the people who wanted to go to these lengths. And strange enough, there were no big pictures of Hitler or any German officials or anything like that. It was just purely the national flag and pageantry and National Socialist banners and things like that. It was simply out of this world. And I can well remember listening to these bands until past 11 o'clock p.m., drinking the Rhine wine and partaking of the luxury which prevailed. Now, I say this intentionally because luxury did prevail. It must be remembered this luxury was earned, not given. It must be remembered this was earned by the Germans in a world which had been made semi-hostile by the press. But purely it had been earned on account of their integrity, their hard work, their absolute guts in pulling themselves up after the National Socialist Party had put into operation their economic plans. And it must be remembered they had some very clever men in the party, in spite of all the nonsense which the press at the time and since have heaped upon these people, like the lies they have said, for instance, about the Anschluss We didn't realize this before the war, but the amalgamation, or rather the referendum which was held in Austria, whereby the Austrians had the option of stating whether or not they would be allow themselves to be incorporated within the Greater Reich. This was written, if anyone takes the bother to go into any of the libraries of the existent large British daily papers, surely they are still to be found, of what was printed on the headlines previous to the 39 war. A 90% ya in favour of being incorporated with Germany. So much, of course, for what they have since been, we've since been told by the press, our press, all which emanates, of course, from all over the world, mainly from America, which tells us, or still speaks in terms of the rape of Austria. This is absolute nonsense. In view of the fact that they were receiving no help from outside, one can well and truly ask, where did their luxury come from? Where did their wealth come from? Were it not only from the fact of their pure hard work? They were stating at that time, in 39, just previous to my visit to Germany, they were saying such things in the Daily Mirror and the Daily Sketch and all the rest of the daily papers, that in Germany existed guns before butter. But actually, one idiot actually went as far as to say the Germans were growing some particular type of tree whereby they could use the sawdust to make sausages. Articles of this description were an everyday occurrence in Britain in those days. One only needed to have taken the trouble to have gone to these places. No one was held in check. You could go anywhere you like in Germany. One could take cameras, one could take photographs. In fact, you were welcome to do so. I actually got permission to go into one of the bigger stores in Cologne, a firm that are known, as anyone may recall, if they knew Germany at all, Karl Peters, in the Hofstrasse in Cologne, for something like Selfridges in Oxford Street, the top floor of which was devoted purely to consumable food. All the things you can think of. I took many pictures at the time. Butter, cheese, eggs, bacon, you name it, it was all there. Now, how was it possible, under any other system, with any other race that you like to name, that within 6 years, 1933, when the National Socialist Party came to power in Germany, with millions and millions of unemployed, with no gold in the country, no assets, but most of the people outside, including the media and one thing or another, hating their guts on account of the fact that they put their finger on the cause of most of their trouble and had solved it, how can one account for that in such 6 years, which is a comparatively very, very short time, how was it possible that they could have got rid of, absorbed all the unemployed and reached a stage, not only a stage of prosperity, but a stage of preparedness? You must recall that in between that period of 1933, they had accepted the vote of the Austrians to become part of the Third Reich. The free cities of Memel and Danzig had also voted to become part of the Reich. They had reinstalled the area, the Sudeten area of Czechoslovakia. This was done by force. This, I know, the Germans marched into Czechoslovakia because the Sudetens wanted to become back part of their homeland. It must be recalled, most people have no memory, or a very short memory indeed. They do not realize that Czechoslovakia did not exist previous to the 1418 war. Czechoslovakia was a bastardized hybrid state made up of, what is it, Moravia, Bosnia, and odd places like this. It was a hybrid state. And the Sudeten area was one part of it. And this was the first place, the part that the Germans took back. Now, how many people, how many honest people who would listen to which of what I have to say, had the shoe been on the other foot? I wonder how people, for instance, in Essex, who lived in Essex, in England, would have sat quiet had Surrey been put under Polish rule, and many of their racial relations and in-laws were forced to live their way, or forced to become part of some other small conglomerate. I wonder how they would have reacted. Would they have reacted any different? Personally, I do not think they would have done. Those who make out they would merely show their hypocrisy, in my opinion. I recall that during this visit to Germany, my main base was a small hotel which was let onto a kind of a circus, something like a small Piccadilly circus, in a place which was then known as Barbarossaplatz in Cologne. And early one morning, a particular noise took me to the window, and I looked to see, and there must have been then what probably was a unit, a rather a large unit, probably a division of soldiers passing through this particular area. All the other traffic had stopped while they passed through. Lorry load after lorry load of well-dressed and smart-looking troops with all the hardware and everything was passing through. Where they were going, I don't know. I could only guess. With hindsight, I would say they were probably on their way northeast towards the Polish frontier, where the trouble ensued very shortly afterwards. But to go back to the most important part of the whole business, what is most amazing about it, how it, this could have been brought about in such a short time. I mean, after all, from 33 to 39 is a very short time to get rid of a huge quantity of unemployed. I do not know the exact amount of unemployed, but there must have been many millions of unemployed when Hitler took over. When President Hindenburg called him in as Reich Chancellor in 1933 until 1939, when the war started, was just about 6 years. Well, I personally do not know another race or nation which could have achieved what they had achieved in such a short time. They were so strong, and they'd done this without the help of outside money. It's all very well for people today, may turn around and say, oh, they've done this and they've done that and they had the other and they had this and they did that, but the fact is that they had nothing. What they'd done entirely. They used their own coal, they used their steel, they used everything they'd got to build their, what they did build. Could anyone conjecture what they could have done had that war been delayed for another 6 years? I would venture to say, ladies and gentlemen, having been a soldier myself, and I know just a little about this kind of thing, they would have been well nigh invincible. And I think personally, it is a sorry day for the whole world that they were not invincible, because we have to go through the agony now of seeing one country after another fall to the mortal enemy of man, communism. So much for my recollections and knowledge of the early days before the 39-45 war with Germany. One last thing I would say about it, which I think had a big bearing on the whole economic angle associated with Germany in those days was the fact that the Germans assessed the value of the Deutschmark upon the internal value of the nation, whereby it had nothing whatever to do with gold, nothing whatever to do with the American Federal Reserve Bank or any other Federal Reserve Bank or external merchant banks of any description. No one outside could juggle with the economy of Germany. Now this is very simple. I will make one observation on this. They had a very clever man there at the time, Dr. Schuck. He was known at the time as the financial wizard of Germany. And it was he and he alone who actually put Germany back on her feet from an economic point of view. Plus the work of the German people and the brains of our technicians to use and exploit the natural resources and wealth of the German nation. Well, I would say once again is how they achieved what they did achieve in such a short time. It surpasses my belief even today. I will give my impressions of what I saw after the conflict. After Germany had been beaten into the ground by the 1,000 bomber raids, after she had withstood siege, I know not of another nation in the world which could have withstood such an onslaught for so long a period. I would like to make a correction. Earlier on the tape, I mentioned, while speaking of the train, I said plane. Well, of course, that was a slip of the tongue. We never had the ability to travel on planes in those days. It was a train.